2013, the year that tornadoes ravaged the Midwest, including the Champaign County town of Gifford, the year that movie critic Roger Ebert died, leaving behind a body of work that earned him a Pulitzer Prize and the affection of many, including those in Champaign-Urbana, where he grew up, the year that Illinois lawmakers passed bills authorizing same-sex marriage, medical marijuana, the carrying of concealed weapons, and state pension reform, pending an expected court challenge. I'm Jim Meadows. Today on Focus, we'll talk about some of the news highlights of 2013 with reporters Ryan Mackey, Sean Powers, and Jeff Bossert. Our program continues after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Today is the next to last day of 2013, and the most important news event of the year could happen tomorrow, for all I know. But on this 364th day of the year, we'll look back at some of the top news stories that have happened in Illinois and the region this year so far. This is not a top 10 list, and we don't claim to be mentioning every big event during this program. In fact, if you have your own ideas about the big news stories in Illinois and our region for 2013, send them in. Our toll-free number at Focus is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. Email us at will-talk@illinois.edu, and we welcome your input on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. Joining me to review the events of 2013 is Brian Mackey from the State House Bureau of Illinois Public Radio. Welcome to Focus, Brian.
How you doing today?
Okay, and you should be all warmed up on this because just a few days ago you were on State Week in Review talking about some of the top stories.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's right.
And later on, Illinois Public Media's Jeff Bossert will join us to talk about a couple of the year's events. Right now, let's say hello to Illinois Public Media's Sean Powers. Hello, Sean.
Good morning, Jim.
And Sean has spent a lot of time in the last month or so covering the after effects of the November 17th tornado outbreak. Now, that outbreak sent tornadoes out over Illinois and six other states, plus straight-line winds in four additional states. Seven people were killed across the Midwest that day. In Illinois, towns like Washington and Tazewell County, Brookport, in Massac County in southern Illinois, they were among the hardest hit. Another town suffering major damage was Gifford, and that's a town of just under 1,000 people in northeast Champaign County. A tornado there destroyed more than 20 homes and damaged 200 others on November 17th. Now, Sean, that tornado hit, I understand, shortly before 1 p.m. that day. When did you get word of it?
Well, I heard about it fairly quickly. I tried to get there as soon as possible. I remember arriving within the hour. Gifford was lucky in the sense that there were no deaths. But just being there right after the storm hit, that monster EF3, it really did a number on the town. Complete devastation. Homes were toppled, trees unrooted, debris just everywhere. And, you know, you don't really prepare yourself for something like that. You try to make sense of it. You try to blend in. You try to observe. You talk to people. You get their initial reactions. And what's interesting about a disaster like that is many people in that town, at least what I saw, their first response wasn't just to, you know, shy away. It was to help their neighbors, to pick up the pieces. And that's really what Gifford has been doing all along since that storm. I got there and I kept talking to people, you know, trying to get as many stories, as many voices. And I remember walking past St. Paul's Lutheran Church, which was not damaged in the storm. And I saw a mother, Judith Singh. She'd moved to Gifford about 2 months before the storm. And she says she came basically eye to eye with the tornado. She said it ripped through her home. She had six kids at home at the time. Fortunately, they walked out pretty much unscathed. I mean, Judith had a few scratches on her back. She was obviously very upset when I met up with her. But there was also this sense of relief that, you know, it could have been much worse, and it wasn't worse. They did lose a lot. Her children weren't injured. I met with her and her daughter, Autumn, just outside of the church. They were staring at a few boxes of clothing, basically what they could salvage from their home. Judith was sobbing and told me the tornado basically took almost everything away.
The tornado came through our house, literally. We live on West Plum, and it took it completely out.
It went through your house?
It literally went through the house. We could see it. I could hear it. I saw it coming at us, and I just started screaming, oh, God, and ran and grabbed a blanket and barely got a blanket over them. I didn't get a blanket over me, and I was getting hit with glass and everything, keeping them from getting hit.
Where were you when all this happened?
I was in the hallway with my brothers and sisters.
I threw her and them first and covered them up.
I'm amazed to see you're standing out here in the cold outside of the church. You're not at a hospital.
I'm not leaving what I got left.
What do you have left? What's in front of you?
About 4 totes of clothes. That's all I could get out.
I see some boxes, clothes, water.
Mm-hmm. That's about all I could get out of there. Nothing else before we could get out. Yeah. It started falling in.
You guys weren't downstairs in the basement?
There is no basement.
You have no basement?
And ironically, the place they tell you to go for a tornado was taken out worse, and I had to get the woman out of there that was trapped.
What do you mean?
There's a house next door that's got a huge basement, and they tell us to go there. But for some reason, it hit so fast I couldn't get them out. I just got them into the hallway. And the next thing when I got them out, I got them to the street, I heard her screaming, and I ran back to try and get to the neighbor. And she had gas pouring out of her house, and she was trapped, and that's where they wanted us to go. So I'm glad we didn't go there.
You're talking to me. We're having a conversation. You're not critically injured. You're not dead. Is that what's going through your mind right now?
No. Where do I go from here? What do I do from here? We lost everything.
But a home is replaceable.
Yeah. That's the thing. Once you know everybody's safe, you start to wonder, what do you do now? What do you do now?
Yeah, and that's a good question. That's what the community is still asking. I feel it's strange. I've been trying to go back to Gifford about once a week at least since the storm. And my memories of Gifford are post-tornado. You go through the now, you still see homes devastated, destroyed. They look like graveyards almost, the homes.
I take it now there's been a lot of cleanup.
There's been a lot of cleanup. It looks a lot better than it did before, but there's still a long way to go. And so that's my memory of Gifford, but I also know of this community that's still really coming together. And I think a really good example of what a community like that can do in terms of helping people get past it is, I guess about a week after the storm, I went over to the Gifford Grade School, which wasn't seriously damaged. Classes were back in session the day after. And I was just amazed. I walked into the gymnasium in the morning. Rod Grimsley, the school principal and superintendent, was talking to students about what happened, about some of the adjustments with portable water stations and bottles, water in classrooms. And I was just amazed that the kids were chatterboxes. It was as if nothing had happened. One kid was talking about playing a video game, and I peeked into one of the classrooms later on, and I was observing a teacher there. And she was trying to present a sense of normalcy. Normal is a word I've been hearing a lot of when I go there. And she asked the children, she basically asked the children, what are they thankful for? And one student said surviving the tornado. Another said the tornado did not hit at night when he was in bed. Another said she was thankful that all of her family and friends survived. And I think a big reason they were able to sort of come in to school that way, not broken, is because they had just so much support in the community, and they were able to help out in a way.
Well, now there's going to be a lot of rebuilding in Gifford. How has that proceeded in the past few weeks? I understand there's state and federal aid coming in, but how have the people in Gifford organized themselves to get this rebuilding done?
Right. Well, we may remember back in 2012, a deadly tornado hit the southern Illinois town of Harrisburg. FEMA denied that town federal assistance. There were concerns this time around that we would see the same sort of refusal, but 15 Illinois counties, including Champaign, were approved for federal disaster assistance, and FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, along with other agencies, insurance providers, have been working with families on settling claims and getting them money and assistance. There has been some work at the local level. Gifford State Bank has set up a fund with contributions from all over the country. There's a committee of people in Gifford, school officials, nursing home official, the people with the village, who are basically every Monday meeting to look over applications from residents who need assistance and deciding how much to give and what to give. And they said they're going to be doing that until there's no more need. Separately, we're just seeing, again, so much generosity in the community to really help people get back on their feet, donating items.
One of the people that you brought up was Christina Gann, who's been part of the doing the organizing of the relief efforts out of, I guess, St. Paul's Lutheran Church has become a sort of headquarters for a lot of the work being done in Gifford right now.
Oh yeah, it has. I would say she's a notable person in this recovery. Many people are, but she's been doing a lot of work organizing a large food pantry, donations, and for her the next step in that process, that recovery, was forming a committee to match the needs of people affected by the storm with available resources offered by different organizations like the Red Cross, Habitat for Humanity. Last week, I went over to Gifford. She held a meeting at the church to give people more information about some of these additional resources.
We don't know what those resources are going to look like yet, but I know that after seeing what God has done for the last 6 weeks in Gifford, I can only imagine what He has planned for the next 6 months. This is a process that we are just beginning, but I wanted you to know that we are actively working to get some things done around here. And while the getting things done is not necessarily going to be something that we can physically see, there's still a lot of activity that we're going to be able to do over these next several months.
And yeah, during that meeting, there were a lot of really good questions. She had folks fill out a needs analysis form, basically, to assess what their level of need was. And this includes people who may not have insurance. And she's basically telling them that they have until January 10th to fill out that form. It's available at the Gifford State Bank. And that's just another example of something happening at the local level to really help out. And I think one thing to note is if you go to the church, you're going to see a lot of items, supplies, toiletries, toys, food that's sitting there more than a month later. There's been so much that's been donated that, I mean, there's no shortage, and that's incredible.
But there's, of course, still a lot of work to be done. Final question, Sean, what's ahead for Gifford, and how are people prepared for all that rebuilding that still lies ahead?
Well, again, if you go there now, you're going to see a lot of debris, and I would say that we're not going to see real the heavy lifting in terms of the rebuilding until the spring when it gets a little bit warmer outside. But right now, a big focus is to continue to get assistance from the insurance companies, the federal government, the local level. You know, also a big focus is to remind people that Gifford is their home. They shouldn't leave. Many people are now living in Rantoul, but they can still call Gifford home. I met a family last week, and they have no intention of leaving Gifford. They're living in Rantoul, and they said, within a year, we're going to be back here. This will be our home, and we're not moving. And actually, the husband of the couple, he had lived in Ogden, and that he said he witnessed three different major storms, tornadoes there. And he kind of joked that, you know, if you want to live anywhere, live near me, because I always make it through these things. And so there's some of that humor, that charm, and you're seeing that now. I guess maybe in a final example of what's ahead. There's work being done at the University of Illinois to possibly offer victims of the tornadoes throughout the Midwest a quick, eco-friendly, and potentially affordable way to rebuild their homes. In 2009, architecture and engineering students from the U of I began an investigation into how to rapidly build energy-efficient housing after a natural disaster, and that was connected to the 2011 solar decathlon competition through the U.S. Department of Energy. And essentially, they want to take what they learned from that and apply it to hard-hit communities like New Minden, Gifford, and Washington. And so, and Habitat for Humanity of Champaign County is also looking at ways it can help in the rebuilding. So this is really just kind of a next chapter for this community and many other communities that are really still picking up the pieces. And
I know the solar decathlon involves the building of demonstration houses, small ones, which are super energy efficient. It'll be interesting how they apply that to any rebuilding efforts in Gifford.
I mean, the thing to also, from our perspective, is, like I mentioned earlier, I've been trying to go out there once a week. The story doesn't end 6 months from now. It doesn't end a year from now. This is something that we're going to continue paying close attention to because, even when it physically looks fine, there are people who are living there now who are still in shock in some ways. It feels like it happened a year ago. It feels like it happened a week ago to them. It just depends. And I mean, how do you try to put together those pieces, emotional pieces? It's going to take a really long time, and we're going to try to be there for that.
And you can multiply that by all the damage the tornado outbreak did in New Minden and Washington and Brookport and other
towns throughout
the Midwest. Sean Powers, thank you very much for joining me on Focus today to talk about that tornado outbreak on November 17th and what happened in Gifford.
Well, thank you.
And this is Focus, our year in review program. where we're looking back on some of the top stories of 2013. And if you have some ideas of what you think the big stories of the year are, write them in. Email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We welcome your input also on Facebook and Twitter, where you can find us at Focus 580. Standing by patiently, Brian Mackey at the Statehouse Bureau at Illinois Public Radio. And Brian, I wanted to ask you about some of the legislative measures that got passed this year. And I'm thinking, I know a lot of people have said things about Congress in Washington being relatively unproductive this year. But it looks like in Springfield, the General Assembly got a lot of stuff done.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the people talk about Congress being unproductive because of party polarization. You don't have that in Springfield because you do have party dominance in one way. I mean, Democrats control both the House and the Senate. They have supermajorities there. And although there are a lot of contentious issues in Illinois that don't fit neatly into those partisan lines, people, the sort of bitterness and polarization that's come to mark Washington politics has not necessarily spread down to Springfield.
Well, let's go ahead and take a look at some of the measures. And first off, pension reform. After years of wrangling, lawmakers passed and Governor Quinn signed a pension reform bill earlier this month. It covers state employees and public school teachers outside Chicago, but its future is uncertain, with a group of teachers and school administrators already filing a lawsuit against it just this past Friday. Here's part of Brian's report on the bill when it passed earlier this month.
So picture your favorite teacher ready to retire after 30 years of service. Her initial pension starts out at $67,000. Right now, after 20 years of retirement, that would grow to more than $120,000. But under the new system, it would only reach $91,000. That's a cumulative difference of more than $280,000.
There's only one way to describe that kind of blatant taking of one's life savings. We call it theft.
Dan Montgomery is president of the Illinois Federation of Teachers. He points to a section of the Illinois Constitution that seemingly bans this sort of thing. It says membership in a government pension system is a contractual relationship, the benefits of which shall not be diminished or impaired.
And Brian Mackey, I assume that Dan Montgomery's argument is exactly what was brought up in that lawsuit that was filed last Friday.
That's right. I mean, the basic premise here is that because the Illinois Constitution protects pensions, you can't really do anything that reduces them. And this was a group of non-union retired teachers. There are certainly going to be bigger fish coming into this. Some of the big, powerful unions that represent state employees, that represent tens of thousands of workers in state government, are going to be filing lawsuits and challenging this pension legislation on that very point.
I was wondering if, as the justices consider this case, if they'll look at what's been going on in Detroit, where, of course, that city declared bankruptcy. And I believe a judge in one of the questions coming before that came up before the bench ruled that at least in that case that pensions and other contracts, just because they're held by a city, are not especially sacrosanct any more than any other contract law that comes up when a government just doesn't have any money.
You know, I know that it's been a popular analogy to make that comparison, right? And people say Illinois is the new Detroit because we're going down the tubes. But I don't necessarily think they're analogous. One, Detroit was in bankruptcy. It was a federal bankruptcy judge who looked at this and said that this, you know, the bankruptcy of the city under federal bankruptcy law is, you know, trumps this provision in the Michigan Constitution. I think in Illinois, state government is meeting its bills. I mean, they're delaying a lot of bills, and that's a separate issue. But I mean, the state does have enough money to pay people in its pensions and has enough money to send to schools and everything like that for quite a long time. The issue here is that it's having to pay less. It's having to spend less on other things like prisons and education and state police and road improvement. It's having to spend less on that in order to fund that money into pensions. But you'd have a pretty hard time saying that the state is so broke that it's going to become insolvent. I mean, there have been other proposals out there to sort of re-amortize the pension debt. Right now, we're on this track to have it 90% funded by 2045. The new law changes that to full funding eventually. But there have been arguments that you could just change the math and say, well, we're just going to extend it out another 20 years, pay a little bit less as we go along in the current years. And, you know, eventually we'll still get to that target. It's just going to be farther in the future. I'm not sure that the two situations are necessarily analogous. Then again, on the other hand, the Illinois Supreme Court has looked at various provisions in the Illinois Constitution that a lot of people who study these things thought they understood. One prominent example is there's another clause in the Constitution that says the state of Illinois shall have the primary responsibility for funding public education. And people thought that that meant the state had to pay the majority of the money that goes to public schools. And the Supreme Court ruled that was simply aspirational. So I'm not sure that this is necessarily analogous to the Detroit case, but on the other hand, there's really no telling what the court's going to do on this.
Well, in the meanwhile, the pension reforms are supposed to take effect, I believe, in June. But how long will this court battle last before we know how much, if any, of the pension reform law is allowable under the Illinois Constitution?
That's a difficult question to answer, but I think we can certainly say that it's going to be longer than June, certainly when this is slated to take effect. And so one of the real questions is the state goes and puts its budget together for next year, and that starts on July 1st. And will they count these changes? I mean, they're counting on saving a lot of money from this plan to be able to spend that on other things. And the question is, will they be able to do that? Or will they sort of take credit for these changes, even though, they're not necessarily approved by the court yet?
And, you know, the final thing that comes to mind is, let's say the court clears the entire pension bill, just saying, if they were to do that, and all the proposed savings go into effect, will it work? That is, do we know if these reforms would substantially improve the health of the state pension system and the Illinois government's financial picture overall? Is there a general agreement that it would or would not, or would up to a point?
There's agreement among sort of the power structure in the state, the people who are in power now, the governor, the House Speaker, the Senate president. I mean, and even a lot of who are all Democrats, I should say. And there are even a lot of Republicans who are in power now who do believe that this would make a significant difference down the line. There are some people outside of power, like Bruce Rauner, who's a millionaire or billionaire businessman who is running for governor, who contends that this is not doing enough. But I think that's more, I would say, more of an outsider view. If these are, and that's a huge if this is something that's approved by the courts, I think it would, definitely save the state money down the line. But there are other budget issues coming up, namely the expiration of the tax increase, or I should say the rolling back of the tax increase. Right now, the personal income tax rate for people in Illinois is 5%, and that's scheduled to roll back at the end of the calendar year 2014. And that's going to be another multi-billion dollar hole in the budget that they're either going to have to make massive cuts or extend the tax increase or find something else to plug that hole.
And that's going to be a big question that the lawmakers and the governor will have to deal with this year ahead as they work on the 2015 budget.
And the 2014 elections, don't forget. Okay. I think that is it's all going to be tied together, and I would argue that that's probably going to be the biggest issue coming up this year.
Well, we'll get to the elections part later in the show. Let me go to another piece of legislation, which I was reminded of as I came to work this morning here at Campbell Hall on the University of Illinois campus, where on the door on the Clark Street entrance was a sticker with a bar sinister over a smoke over a gun. No guns in Campbell Hall, and that's in recognition of the concealed carry law, which was passed and signed into law last summer.
You know, those debates on public radio can get pretty heated, so it's probably a good idea that you guys are not going to be allowing firearms into the studios there. But yeah, that's something.
Yeah, we're
that we
a hot-tempered
here.
Bunch here. That's right.
Yeah, exactly. We saw that on the Capitol as well. They've put up these signs. The Bar Sinister is the, you know, the red circle with a line through it over a little handgun. These are state-regulated signs. Concealed carry is becoming law in Illinois. There's actually, we're taping this Monday morning, but there's going to be a news conference later today where they're going to talk about the progress of that. People will begin being able to apply online starting next year, and then eventually later in the year they'll start accepting paper applications. There was some controversy over that, but that's kind of a side issue. But yeah, concealed carry is coming to Illinois.
This law is sure to be popular in much of Illinois, but perhaps less so in Chicago and Cook County, where support for gun control has been higher. And I understand, Brian, that local law enforcement has some leeway in deciding who gets to carry, who gets to get a concealed carry permit. Could those applications come out differently in the Chicago area than they do downstate?
We've already heard Cook County Sheriff, and Cook County, of course, is home to Chicago and many other urban areas there where there's a lot of densely packed people. We've already heard the sheriff up there, Tom Dart, say that he intends to take a very close look, scrutinize a lot of these applications. I think the idea behind doing this, I'm reminded there was a great This American Life episode about the bully of Tolone, I think was the name of the town. So it's in sort of western Illinois. And
Tolono, perhaps.
Tolono, maybe that's it. Maybe that's it. I'm trying to stretch my memory back there. But it was a guy who was sort of well known around the town. Maybe he'd never really done enough to go to jail, but he was just a terrible bully. And I think it's the idea that law enforcement wants to be able to say, yeah, maybe we don't have a perfect case against this guy where we can send him to prison for something, but this is not the type of person we want walking around with a firearm. Now, the backers of this law are, want that to be a very small minority, an exception. And so that, the presumption is that, you have a right under the Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution to carry a firearm to protect yourself in public. And that if we're going to deprive you of that right, there has to be a high burden. But like you said, people in Chicago, Cook County, certainly the governor is not a fan of this legislation. They want to restrict that right as much as they can.
And we should note that this law is now in place because essentially a federal judge ordered the state of Illinois to come up with a law saying that it couldn't have nothing. It could have maybe a concealed carry law that's more restrictive than other states. And maybe this is more restrictive than some other states, but they had to have something.
It is more restrictive than some other states, but it's not as restrictive, I think, as it might have been had they passed this law before that court decision. By the court saying Illinois has to do this, that gave leverage to the gun rights supporters in Illinois, the National Rifle Association and groups like that, because they could say, we're not going to have a New York or Maryland style system where you have to prove that you're under threat. And it's very restrictive and very hard to get a firearm. Yes. So they say Illinois is the last state, but there are some states where it's very difficult to be able to do this. On the other hand, Illinois is not going to be like some of the states out west and in the south where, you barely need to do anything. There's just sort of a presumptive right to carry firearms. So there are training requirements. You have to take a class. You have to be certified. You have to go through background checks. You have to supply fingerprints. You have to carry a license. There are restrictions on where you can take your firearms. Like you said, the University of Illinois college campuses are one of those places. Schools, businesses can post that same sign on their door, and then you would not be able to take your firearm if a business owner chooses to do that. So it's falls somewhere in the middle in terms of the most strict to the least strict.
Well, let's go ahead, Brian, over to another piece of legislation which came out of the General Assembly this year, and that was a bill permitting same-sex marriages in the state of Illinois. Governor Pat Quinn signed it in November, the same month it won final approval in the General Assembly. In the Illinois House debate, both supporters and opponents had said the bill touched on individual rights.
We are a family that is treated differently under the eyes of the law. We are a family that does not have the same protections that your family has.
I've had three judges in my district call up and say, David, there is not a facility in your district that's going to perform me ceremonies. They're going to call me. Where's my religious individual freedoms?
And that's openly gay Chicago area Democrat Sam Yingling and only Republican David Rice taking different sides of the same sex marriage debate in the House debate. The House debate and vote came several months after a same-sex marriage passed in the Senate. House Speaker Michael Manekin sort of managed to keep it delayed while he tried to find the support for the measure. Where was the opposition, Brian, in particular? I know that very few Republicans voted for it, but how did but what kept the Democratic majority in the House waiting for several months before they voted on, before they brought the bill to a vote and approval?
Yeah, like you said, this was obviously Republicans were almost in lockstep in opposition to this. I think three or four in the end out of the entire General Assembly who are Republicans ended up voting in favor of this. But on the Democratic side, you had opposition from two places. You had downstate Democrats and you had African-Americans in the Chicago area mostly, and who had a lot of ministers and very religious people in their districts kind of pushing back against this move to legalize same-sex marriage. And I think that the reason, this is why the fact that the Democrats have these supermajorities in Illinois, it can be a little misleading. People think that they can just do whatever they want, they can steamroll, but especially on these social issues, the reason the Democrats have such large majorities is that they permit ideological diversity within their party. It's that big tent that you often hear that cliche about. You know, they want, hey, if you're opposed to abortion, opposed to same-sex marriage, you favor gun rights, but you still want to be a Democrat and you'll vote for House Speaker Mike Madigan and Senate President John Cullerton when that question comes up once every 2 years. Welcome to the party. We want you in the Democratic Party. And so because they permit that kind of ideological diversity, it can be more difficult to push these kind of things through that you might think, well, Illinois is a blue state, therefore it would be one of the first to do this. So you had African-American ministers making a big push against this. Obviously, the Catholic Church made a very strong push in Illinois against same-sex marriage. Right here in Springfield, our bishop has been very outspoken about this issue, and that is why it took so long. And I don't know that I would, you mentioned House Speaker Mike Madigan allowing it to come for a vote. I don't know that I would put this all on Speaker Madigan. He did actually work very hard to pass this legislation, twist some arms, I think, to get people to vote for it. But it was really, I mean, I think by all accounts, it was up to the sponsor, a gentleman named Representative Greg Harris, a Democrat from Chicago, another openly gay legislator who has been working this issue very hard. And he came under a lot of fire earlier this year in May. There was a palpable vocal disappointment in the Capitol when he stood up on the very last night of session to say that he was not going to call the bill. People I don't know if catcalling is the right term, but they were groaning in the galleries of the House about their disappointment. But he knows the politics. He's a very hard worker, and he slowly, methodically worked the bill, rounded up the votes, and was able to finally get it passed in November.
Brian, are we going to see court cases in the year ahead? Opponents of the bill have argued that religious groups and people with religious beliefs against same-sex marriage will have their rights curtailed by this law. Are we going to see legal cases on those issues as this law goes into effect?
You know, that's certainly possible. I think it's an interesting question. One of the examples we heard from Representative Rice earlier there, I believe it was, who talked about, you know, a florist or if you make wedding cakes or something like that, and a gay couple comes in and wants you to do a his and his cake or something like that, or wants you to bring the flowers to their wedding. I'm not sure that it would be legal to discriminate against them whether or not there was same-sex marriage, right? We have an anti-discrimination law in Illinois, certainly in matters of employment. And so, yeah, I suppose that you will have people who, you know, because of it, and I don't want to sell this short, people do have deeply held religious beliefs. They cite the Bible. And certainly if you're a Catholic, for example, it's very clear where the church hierarchy stands on this issue. They are opposed to same-sex marriage. And, people have that deeply held belief. And perhaps if you do run a flower shop or something like that, and you're asked to sort of participate or enable this, you do feel that there is something morally wrong about that. And you don't want to be forced to do it. But, there have been other sorts of discrimination that people tried to do in the past, maybe because of racially mixed or religious mixed marriages. And I think that, over time, those have seemed to be less acceptable forms of discrimination. Sometimes it had to go through the courts to get there, and it remains to be seen whether that will happen with same-sex marriage as well.
Well, Brian, I want to come back to you a little later on in the program. Right now, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk with Illinois Public Media's Jeff Bossert about the passing of film critic and Urbana native Roger Ebert and other top stories of 2013. I'm Jim Meadows. This is Focus on WILL. And we're back on Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and we're looking at some of the things that happened in Illinois and the region in 2013 with Brian Mackey of Illinois Public Radio, Sean Powers, and Jeff Bossert of Illinois Public Media. If you have some ideas on what you think was the biggest state or local story of the year, give us an email at will-talk@illinois.edu, and we're on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. Jeff Bossert of Illinois Public Media is with me right now, and we're talking at this point about one of the big news stories around the state and certainly here in Champaign-Urbana, the passing of Roger Ebert. He was perhaps the nation's best-known movie critic, but he was especially known in Illinois. He was the longtime critic for the Chicago Sun-Times, and he always kept touch with his hometown of Urbana and Champaign. He grew up here, and he went to school at the University of Illinois, and he kept his connection in later years by hosting an annual film festival in Champaign bearing his name. Roger Ebert's death last April at the age of 70 came just weeks before the 15th edition of the Roger Ebert Film Festival was to begin, and here's how Roger's wife, Chaz Ebert, introduced the festival.
I am so happy to be with you this evening. I was hoping that, I always called Roger my boyfriend. I was hoping that my boyfriend would be here with me, and he's not, so I wore his scarf tonight. I just want to say thank you. The 15 years of this film festival have been so meaningful to me and to Roger. You gave Roger so much joy coming here year after year to the festival at his alma mater, in his hometown. It made him so happy. And he wanted to make sure that the festival continues. And so we'll see what we can do about that. But tonight, this week, for the next 5 days, we're going to celebrate Roger.
And Jeff Bossert, a beloved and film critic, are not words that often go together, but they seem to do so in the case of Roger Ebert, especially in Champaign-Urbana, where he grew up. What about Roger Ebert made him special in this way?
Well, I think one thing to point out about Roger is he never forgot where he came from. You only have to go back to our archives. If you search Ebert on the WILL website, it wasn't just stories about Ebert Fest or that he's hosting a festival. I mean, he made a number of appearances on WILL radio and TV. And I hosted a show during that same time, April 18th, during the Ebert Fest. We had people scheduled to join us, but we had people who voluntarily called in about Roger returning to the community, not just for Ebert Fest, but for class reunions and that kind of thing. We had classmates who called in from Urbana High School, and one of our longtime hosts, Steve Shoemaker, who did the show Keeping the Faith, was a classmate of Roger's at Urbana High School. He made a point of coming back to the community, not just from film festivals, but stayed in touch with people for a long, long time here.
How did the Ebert Film Festival develop? And, I haven't been there recently. I went there last, maybe 7 or 8 years ago. And, Virginia Theater is a big theater. It's always packed for this event. There are people who are really up for being there. What has made this event so popular?
Well, it started with a screening of 2001, A Space Odyssey, one of Roger's all-time favorite films. It was part of a cyberfest in the late 1990s. In fact, that was discussed during a program that Steve Shoemaker did with Ebert some time ago. There was a sold-out crowd of that screening at the Virginia, and that prompted what was then known as the College of Communications, now the College of Media, to host this film festival. And Ebert had initially declined, saying he wasn't in the habit of asking studios for favors, being a critic, but then he realized, why don't we make this something that overlooks movies that didn't get a fair shake?
Looks at overlooked movies.
Exactly. And I think, so Ebert Fest has been popular Because of some of the films that he's shown, he's not only brought in little-known films, but also a big 70-millimeter print of something like 2001 or Lawrence of Arabia or something along those lines. But it's also, I think, just become this great communal experience where people from not from the area will make a point of meeting every spring for this film festival. And then you have all these terrific actors and directors, other people who have come in to be part of the panel discussions after the films, people like Australian filmmaker Paul Cox, who comes year after year, one of the favorites of Ebert, as a guest at the festival. So people will really look forward to hearing from those guests and just meeting up and watching a few good movies over a few days.
And the plan is to have that festival continue. Roger Ebert is no longer there to choose films for it. I understand they have a backlog of selections that he has made that they hope to draw on. And then I guess they'll find a way to figure out what films to show on their own.
Sure. I mean, and I'd mentioned, I think, one thing that would be a part of that is Ebert had so many books out showing some of his great films. I mean, you could easily open the festival with a great print of one of his favorite films from, U.S. film or many foreign films that he loved. Something along those lines. And that backlog, I'm sure, will take a long time to get through as well. But the College of Media Dean Jan Slater told me after Ebert's passing, there was never a question of ending Ebert Fest. And, of course, this has helped the Virginia survive for a long time as well and some of the rehabbing that wonderful theater's gone through.
And Roger Ebert continued to be active with the film festival, even after his long battle with cancer robbed him of the ability to speak. He was still a presence at the festival and active in its organization up until the end.
He went to the screenings that he could, and coping with his illness, a lot of people said he became even a better writer. He was so active in Twitter and Facebook and just a prolific writer. And here's a guy who just did not stop. And I think because he had lost his voice, he also weighed in on other issues like politics in the news. And he was just, I think, a model in terms of social media for other critics to follow.
And also one final bequest from the Eberts, I guess done before Roger Ebert passed away, was money for a new film studies program at the U of I.
Yes, this won't include degrees per se, but there are courses, I think, that will start in a matter of time. I think this semester some of that is taking shape. A lot of his archival writings can be looked up. There will be seminars all based on the writings of Roger Ebert and his extensive knowledge of film.
Let's turn to another story that, Jeff, you did some reporting on. I did, too, I've come to think of it. And that's in the world of sports, maybe not the only big sports story in the state this year. After all, the Chicago Blackhawks did win the Stanley Cup. But one of the highlights in sports in this area this year has been wheelchair athletics at the University of Illinois, which is a school that's a pioneer in wheelchair athletics, disability sports. This year, their wheelchair track athletes had tremendous success with good showings at the Paralympics and at major marathon events around the world. In fact, one U of I athlete, Tatiana McFadden, is a special standout for her performance in several major marathons this year. Here she is talking about what she does.
I love being an athlete. I love wheelchair racing, and it's just definitely been an incredible journey, and to push my body to the limits and to do what no one has been able to do before.
Well, Jeff, Tatiana McFadden was really a star this year in women's wheelchair racing. Can you summarize her marathon victories this year?
Yes, they were in New York City. That was the most recent one. But New York, Boston, London, and Chicago. The Grand Slam, the Marathon Grand Slam in wheelchair racing. No one else has made that achievement.
And that was the Boston Marathon, of course, where the bombings occurred. Tatiana McFadden was not present at the site at the moment where the bombings occurred, but of course that was a big shock for everyone.
It was a shock. We did get a hold of some of the other athletes at that time, and including some of those in the wheelchairs.
And well, in talking with McFadden, what do you find in her personality that you think that's brought her to this level of success? She really seems to be really committed to it.
Yeah, I think that she's always positive in her outlook. I mean, if she said if there is some sort of injury that prevents her from continuing with her career in athletics. I mean, she's a recent U of I graduate. She might be looking at a career. She is looking at a career in human development. She might be coming back for grad school in this semester, but if not, she might be taking a position in a hospital providing emotional support for families and their children. You know, and she's just one quote I had in a story from her. She says, "No one looks at her differently. You just folks just see me as an elite athlete who runs track and marathon." And she loves sharing these stories. Her future immediately is to determine whether she'll be part of the Winter Olympics in Sochi. She'll find out in January if she made this cross-country skiing team.
And this is a new sport for her.
This is a new sport, and she's a little concerned about the altitude. And, of course, she's been in marathons and not extremely cold weather, but she'll be part of a different climate. And if she makes the team, she'll be going through Italy and Germany training camps very soon. So a pretty intense schedule with her, and she got through all of it in this last semester with finals and training for the Olympics and on the heels of this marathon grand slam.
And in just wrapping up, we should note that this is just one of the athletes in the U of I wheelchair sports program. And I noticed just looking at the marathon results of the races that Tatiana McFadden won, how many other U of I athletes had strong showings in the men's and women's wheelchair divisions? There were just a lot of names that kept on showing up more than once.
Yeah, U of I's had a really terrific showing and really, I think, put the university on the map in terms of training of wheelchair athletes. I mean, the other names that come up if you do a Google search are likely to be Amanda McGrory. She is a 2010 graduate and played wheelchair basketball. She was a champion in the New York City Marathon in 2011. Josh George, 2007 graduate at U of I, and he's been in several events, too many to mention here, 2008 Paralympics in Beijing, 2004 Summer Paralympics. Adam Bleakney, who's head coach of the wheelchair track program, and he's been there 8 years after competing in several events as well. And I know you talked to some of these other athletes on the program.
That's right. It's certainly been a strong program. We've had some of these people on the air, both in news programming and also on Focus as well. I remember talking to Joshua George particularly. But right now, let's go ahead to one more story for this year. And I'm going to bring back Brian Mackey over at the State House Bureau because this is a story which will be running in the 2014. And that's the election, maybe in particular the gubernatorial races. Brian, one thing that strikes me as we go into about the last 6 or 7 minutes we have here is that everybody was expecting at one point that Governor Quinn would be facing a challenge from another Democrat, Attorney General Lisa Madigan, and then she dropped out. And what happened?
Yeah, she had been dropping hints herself about possibly challenging Governor Quinn, and this is not the first time that she sort of played this Hamlet routine, will I, won't I, to be or not to be. She had this happened the last election cycle as well, back in 2010. What happened is that a weird sort of public spat with her father came out. She said she was, and I should say her father is House Speaker Michael Madigan, often referred to as powerful House Speaker Michael Madigan, who's held that position on and off, but almost entirely on for more than 30 years now, she had said it was always going to be that I wouldn't run for governor if my father wasn't going to be stepping down. And she sort of expressed this as though it was a kind of a surprise that her father decided not to step down so she could run for governor. Her father, this is where it kind of gets unusual because he usually plays things very close to the vest. He said she knew what my plans were. And that's basically all the press has had to feast on are these little scraps that they've given out in sort of off the cuff statements that really surprise people, because this is a powerful political family that has gotten that way by playing things very close and keeping very quiet and methodical about their control of Illinois government, and they sort of spilled into the public. But what the end result of this does is that it leaves a virtually clear path for Governor Pat Quinn to run for the nomination. You know, we also had a little flirtation there from Bill Daley, the brother of the former Chicago mayor. Bill Daley had also been a commerce secretary in the Clinton administration, and he was the chief of staff to President Barack Obama for a time. And he was had actually declared that he was going to run for governor in Illinois and ultimately decided that he just didn't have that burning desire to do the sort of horrible work of campaigning and meeting people and shaking hands and kissing babies and going to Rotary clubs and things like that day after day after day, and then actually being governor. I think he just decided that maybe he didn't want to put in the effort that it took. I mean, that's basically what he said. So what this leaves is Governor Quinn has a relatively unknown opponent, a guy named Teo Hardeman, who used to run the Ceasefire Anti-Violence Organization. Not a lot of people think that he's going to be able to get the traction he needs to defeat Governor Quinn. And that's where the Democratic side stands going into next year.
Well, the Republican side has four people hoping to be the nominee against Quinn. State Senator Bill Brady, who was the nominee 4 years ago. Senator Kirk Dillard, who came in second in that primary race. State Treasurer Dan Rutherford and businessman Bruce Rauner. And they obviously all think Quinn is beatable, even in a very Democratic state. And one thing I hear, I don't know, this is really going just by polls, is that that Governor Quinn is not the most popular governor in the history of state politics. Where do these Republicans think they can get him?
Yeah, I mean, you're right about that. Governor Quinn is not the most popular. He's not the least popular. There was a time with some polling that he was actually the least popular governor in the United States, and that is no longer the case, but he's still relatively unpopular. But you have this trend nationwide. You do have blue states that can elect Republican chief executives. We've seen that. New Jersey is considered a blue state. Chris Christie is a Republican governor there. New York City, certainly a blue city, but it had both Mayor Rudolph Giuliani and Mayor Mike Bloomberg for a time. This is not unprecedented. You do have states where Democrats can dominate, and yet they will choose a Republican chief executive. And I think that their main message is fiscal discipline and competence. And they all have different ways of going about it. Bruce Rauner is pouring tremendous amounts of his vast wealth, and it's difficult to overstate how wealthy this gentleman is. His income for the calendar year 2012, he released his tax returns. His income was $53 million for the year. His next closest rivals on the Republican side were in the multiple hundreds of thousands of dollars, 200, 300, something like that. One, you know, Bill Brady's a real estate developer. Kirk Dillard is a corporate lawyer. Dan Rutherford is the state treasurer, obviously, but he has a background as a corporate executive. But their basic message is we will be able to either take on House Speaker Mike Madigan in some cases or work with him in a way that gets him to be a little more, you know, disciplined about spending. That's their message anyway.
So really the fiscal performance of the state is going to be an issue. What sort of strengths, you know, what can Quinn bring up against that?
Well, and that's, I think, why we saw Governor Quinn pushing so hard for both same-sex marriage, because that's something that's an issue that has become very popular among his core voters, Democrats. And we're also going to see him, I think, touting this pension deal. I mean, this is his sister soldier moment, right? If people are familiar with that reference, where Bill Clinton went into his core audience of African-Americans and kind of gave him a stern lecture about the coarsening of the culture back in the 90s. So this is Governor Quinn sticking it to the unions. He can say, you know, the unions are instrumental. Were instrumental in helping Quinn win election back in 2010, and by, you know, really doing the tough work that he had to do to fix the state pension system. This is his message. It shows that he is the responsible guy. He's an adult. He is the man who can get things done. So I think we're going to see him running on both pensions and same-sex marriage.
Well, that's where we're going to end it on this show, looking at the year in review for 2013, some of the top stories around the state and the region. I'm Jim Meadows. This is Focus on WILL.